This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's 110 for a month or more. Can't go outside, hear the AC roar. It's like living in the pressure cooker. Super hot coil. Turn up the gas and burn that oil in the pressure cooker.
Half of scientists polled think we are headed for a 3°C hotter world within a single lifetime. From Exeter University, UK, Professor Tim Lenton returns with the 2024 State of the Climate Report. His colleague at Exeter, Dr. James Dyke, fact-checks a popular climate myth about overshoot. With author and activist Mike Tidwell, we talk hurricanes, Appalachia, and coping. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.
Perilous times on planet Earth.
That is the state of our climate right now in 2024. Who says so? A really impressive group led by Oregon's William Ripple and complete with climate science leaders like Johan Rockström, Michael Mann, Naomi Oreskes, Stefan Rahmstorf, and Thomas Crowther, among many others, all Radio EcoShock guests, by the way, talk us through the latest report in another big name in the field. It's Dr. Timothy Lenton. He is founding director of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter, chair in climate change and earth system science there, and a highly cited publishing scientist. From Exeter, UK, Tim Lenton, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Good to be back.
We have been blown off the map of anything normal. How can scientists like your group help us to understand where we are?
Well, we're just trying to give a clear communication of the planet's vital signs. We do that by keeping track of a whole range of variables that are either the response of the climate itself to human activities or the human activities that are driving the climate change. And we're doing that year on year with this annual report. And once again, it's a shocking year, our assessment for the last 12 months.
And the state of the climate report starts off with a series of gut punches. The first sentence is, "We are on the brink of an irreversible climate disaster." I had to stop and think that one over. Things do seem bad, but is that going too far?
Well, if we're thinking about this as a risk management problem, no, we're just trying to say that it's a bit like you'd approach getting on an aeroplane, I suppose. You want to be pretty sure it's not going to fall out of the sky. But the problem with the climate is the last 12 months or so has shown us some really extraordinary hot temperatures, particularly the ocean surface temperatures are just way out of the range of recent variability. And we're fairly confident now that 2024 is going to be the first year globally on record that's been 1.5 degrees centigrade above the pre-industrial average, or more than that. And unfortunately, the climate science community can't yet come up with a convincing explanation for why the temperatures have deviated from so high and for so long. So I would interpret these extraordinary, we would call it temperature anomaly, as a kind of clear sign that there's some destabilization that's going on or gone on in the climate. And of course, we're hoping the temperatures come back, but they're still on the overall rise, along with a bunch of the other metrics we highlight.
Yes, Earth just went through a natural warming from El Nino plus our human-made heating. Is it possible, Tim, we could see a cooler year or two, or is it just hotter every year from now on? Do we know?
Well, we would expect, with the sort of variability that we get, for example, that El Nino has officially ended and yet the temperatures have stayed high, but we would normally expect that there will be some fluctuations. So we can easily go from a And let's hope we do go from the current extraordinary heat to a cooler year or two. This is just normal that you get these shorter-term fluctuations around a rising average, shall we say. So what's crazy about the current fluctuation above the average is it's just staying there, and it's much larger than we've seen before. But yeah, we would, if we get a strong La Nina, as it's called, we would certainly expect to see some temporary cooling relative to this rising trend. But it's not arrived yet.
Another concern for me, there is not much wildlife out there left. I mean, wild mammals are about 4% of mammal biomass. The rest is all humans and our livestock. Is that a factor in this climate emergency?
Well, it is, particularly in the sense that the ruminant livestock, which is one of the indicators we track, not only are they at a record level, and we add something like 170,000 ruminant livestock to the global population every day, which seems extraordinary, doesn't it? Not only are they at a record level, but of course, ruminant livestock, they take an extraordinary amount of land. They're extremely inefficient, if you like, as a source of calories or protein. And they are an unusually strong source of methane emissions. And the land that they demand is in the global tropics, the single largest driver of tropical deforestation, which, of course, is itself a source of carbon dioxide being released from destroying the trees, essentially. And if we turn to the forest story, well there's a little bit of good news that in the Brazilian Amazon, we saw in the last year a decline in the loss of the forest, although it still is being lost, just at a slower rate. But globally, over the last 12 months, we saw the global loss of tree cover really escalate, and that's partly not just because people were chopping forests down, but rather because there were really unprecedented massive areas of wildfires in the last year. And then that's also carbon that's adding to the atmosphere.
The United Nations process says 1.5 degrees C warming over pre-industrial is the line we should not cross, and I believe 190 countries agreed to that. According to your new report, a 2024 poll finds almost 80% of scientists responding expect heating by at least 2.5 degrees C, fully half, foresee a catastrophic 3 degrees C of warming by the year 2100. Scientists know. Why doesn't the public?
The public, some of them also intuitively realize that things are heading way into the danger zone if we were to carry on with current policies. And that's why some of the public, at least, are joining us scientists in pushing our elected leaders to basically act more decisively in terms of specific policy actions that can accelerate the end of fossil fuel burning, the switch to cleaner, greener power, and so forth, tackling basically the key drivers of climate change.
And last March on Radio EcoShock, you gave us an update on tipping points. Something like slowing the North Atlantic current that keeps the UK weather moderate is huge. You just went through a kind of cool and wet period. It must be making people there nervous. It was bad for farming. But a lot of institutional publications and news media just leave tipping points out as if they don't exist. Tim Linton, what should we be telling ourselves about climate risks possibly bigger than the civilization can handle?
Well, we need to wise up to the fact that that there's a significant risk of crossing climate tipping points that really would be a challenge for our societies, because they can fundamentally change the pattern of climate across the world. So suddenly what seemed like a nice habitable island with a huge number of people on it, like the UK or the UK islands, suddenly becomes a less good place to be if we cross a tipping point in the Atlantic Ocean's great overturning circulation. Now, the key thing in a risk assessment is to recognise that the thing you need to look at first is what's the worst thing that can happen and can I rule it out? And that's why I've been placing an emphasis on looking at these tipping point scenarios, because at the moment we definitely can't rule them out, and the more science we do, the more worrying it gets, because the more, rather than ruling them out, we start to see they look more likely than we thought they were. So, yeah, that's crucial information for all of us, but especially for governments, basically, who need to be putting the possibility of damaging climate tipping points into their risk thinking and their risk management. Because, of course, good governments they do have a process for thinking about risks, and that would include thinking about risks like another pandemic, like the COVID-19 pandemic, or thinking about terrorist risks, or thinking about a war, or yet another war escalating. But our argument, I think, would be pretty clear that these climate tipping point risks are, in some cases, quite a lot bigger if they were to come to pass than any of the other risks I just listed. So they definitely should be in our collective risk thinking, and certainly in our government's risk thinking.
Well, no doubt you have a comfortable home in England. Food in the grocery store is more expensive, but there is food. This new report, though, says we fear the danger of climate breakdown. Do you and other leading scientists believe that society itself could collapse if we get into a permanent state of climate emergency?
I think it's a definite risk. That's partly because when I and my group have looked at the climate model of passing, say, a key climate tipping point in the Atlantic Ocean circulation, combined with the 2.5 degrees of global warming that we should expect under current policies, and as you said, many climate scientists would expect later this century, when you combine those two things, the global warming and the tipping point, we can crop model and quickly discover that the viable area for growing the major staple crops of, say, wheat and maize worldwide reduced by more than a half. So that looks to me like a food security crisis, and it would be underlain by a kind of water security crisis. So that looks like a serious challenge to societies, and it would have many other ramifications as well. The whole pattern of climate would have changed. Of course, we might manage the situation by suddenly eating a lot less of those ruminant livestock, because they're using up a whole lot of agricultural land in the wild. It's hard not to conclude that it'll be extremely challenging to adapt to such a kind of climate shock that manifested as a food and water security shock, including in, you know, some of the richest and most populous nations, let alone for the less well-off people on the planet. Because we also see in that scenario there'd be major disruption of the Indian monsoon, so the a crisis in India and the West African monsoon, so a crisis in the Sahelian regions and countries like Nigeria, one of the most populous countries in the world.
Imagine the sacrifice required to really slash our emissions personally and as an economy. I suppose it is less than sacrificing lives in war, but only just. At the moment, there's not much social or political will to do it. And we've been told for a long time, well, the next 10 years, that's critical, and those 10 years have passed. Is there a point where it is genuinely too late?
Well, there could well be a point at which things become too late, in the sense of too late to avoid the kind of risks that are hard to manage. But I wanted to emphasize that it's not a sacrifice to switch from a fossil fuel-powered societies to renewable energy-powered societies. On the contrary, renewable power is now the cheapest form of electricity in most of the world. In fact, it now makes economic sense in the majority of the world to close existing fossil fuel power stations and replace them with new renewables and battery storage. So we are seeing what I call some positive tipping points to a new energy system. We certainly need policy makers and policy support and governments to get behind those and to realize those opportunities. And they're huge opportunities, because still worldwide, at least 5 million people die every year from fossil fuel air pollution. So, you know, you get multiple co-benefits from going to clean energy. We will also have to tackle our current trend towards eating more and more meat on average worldwide. You know, eating too much red meat can be extremely bad for your health. It's not actually good for you. So everything in moderation in that case, but they're a co-health benefit. A healthier diets are much healthier for the planet.
But we seem to be moving in the wrong direction. I mean, BP, British Petroleum, have backed away from their climate goals. We have governments, whether they're liberal or conservative or whatever you want to call them, are approving new oil and gas drilling leases. Even in Australia, they're expanding coal mines. It's way too late for that kind of stuff. I just wonder, are you hopeful?
I'm pretty despairing when I see those things that you just mentioned, but I always try to remind myself of the bigger picture here, which is we are also seeing the exponential growth of renewable energy accelerating all the time. The same thing with the electrification of mobility, including electric cars, bikes, etc. So it's kind of a race of tipping points. In my head, it's a race to push and bring forward those positive tipping points to accelerate the change we need now versus in order to avoid the bad tipping points in the climate that we're otherwise going to cross. And you're quite right to highlight that what I would call the incumbents, the status quo, fossil fuel burning being part of it, and the meat lobby, they are fighting back hard. And alas, recently they would appear to be winning in some sense in terms of getting these crazy retrogressive movements from business and some governments. But things change quite, you know, they can fluctuate just as in the climate. They can change fast in society as well. So there are some other bigger forces going in the right direction. But we do look to be behaving very collectively stupidly at the moment. And we always pride ourselves for being a supposedly intelligent species, but there's really no evidence we are on this climate crisis, sadly.
I'm old enough to remember you, Michael, Johan, Naomi, and Stefan before climate became controversial and political. Even conservatives spoke of the need to address climate. Maggie Thatcher did. Then research scientists were called to be public speakers and media communicators. I've never seen Stefan Rahmstorf speaking in more forums and tweeting and communicating as much. You yourself, you're getting out, you're making presentations. It's a change from just researching and reporting to the authorities, well, we have climate problems.
Oh, yeah, because we're human beings after all, and we get to stare day in, day out at this extraordinary, shocking evidence of how the climate is changing and the harms it's causing to people. And you can't, on your conscience, not go out and try and alert the world, both to the risks we see unfolding right now, but also try and alert the world to the only viable remaining opportunities to get out of trouble, which is really we have to tip to different technologies and different behaviours, but they actually bring a bunch of benefits with them. But we obviously need our elected leaders to get on board with that change as well. So we're going out to tell the world what the trouble is and how the trouble is escalating, but also, well, what's the only viable ways left to get out of this trouble before it gets too bad for anybody to manage it.
Well, there are unlikely to be massive climate protests in Azerbaijan at the next COP, at the COP climate meeting in November, coming right up. Do you see any signs there could be some changes there that will at least help the climate?
At the COP meeting, I'm not feeling too optimistic of fundamental shifts coming from that process. In terms of the climate movement, I would love to see it back on the streets even more strongly, because I think that just makes it visible for everybody that there is an issue. Even if you as a listener disagree with the tactics of the movement, I think the movement has and can play an essential role in just continually reminding us all about what's happening. And obviously, we do that as scientists in our own slightly different way. But I really do think we need to get this up our mental agenda and in order to fuel the action we need, and of course get it on the political radar in a way that it sticks is a priority for our leaders to address for all of our benefits, frankly. I mean, there's so much to gain in embracing the transition now, especially to clean energy. So what are we waiting for? Well, as usual, it's vested interest in the status quo is what's holding things back.
Tim, we're going to have to wrap this up. What are you and your team working on next?
Well, I've been working on what are the most effective policies to bring forward what I call the positive tipping points in the power sector to renewable energy, in the electrification of cars and trucks, in electrifying the heating of our homes. And we've been able to show that policies that mandate the end of fossil fuel technologies, like you're not going to be able to sell a petrol or diesel car in our market after 2035, or no diesel trucks after 2040, or we're going to close all coal-burning power stations by 2035 in rich nations. Those policies are hugely effective at triggering, amplifying feedbacks that accelerate the change we need, that make the new clean technologies cheaper and better, faster. They're way more effective than carbon taxes that have been talked a lot about. And subsidies are also fairly effective, but mandates are even more effective. So I've really been trying to bring that message out with some real numbers showing, you know, how particular policies could really help us accelerate out of trouble. And on the flip side, me and my group, we're really trying our best to improve our early warning systems and early warning capability for the bad climate tipping points. And we're doing what we can to mine the data we've got available to look for the early warning signals that crucial bits of the climate are losing stability.
Listeners, find out where you do stand. Check out the 2024 State of the Climate Report, Perilous Times on Planet Earth. It is free, it's easy to understand, and full of facts that are a bit hard to hear. You can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Our guest is co-author Dr. Timothy Lenton, founding director of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter. Tim Lenton, thank you for your valuable time and for your warning.
Thanks very much for having me on the show.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Some people see the future more clearly. In 2012, I interviewed American author and activist Mike Tidwell about his book. The title might as well be today's headlines: The Ravaging Tide, Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and the Coming Death of America's Coastal Cities. That is surely where we are now, with double hurricanes and the future of coastal Florida in doubt. Mike Tidwell is the founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. They work on global warming impacts and solutions in Maryland and Virginia and Washington, D.C. and beyond. From Washington, Mike Tidwell, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be here, Alex.
Mike, what hits you most about Hurricanes Helene and Milton striking Florida and then the Southeast?
I suppose it's just the surreal feeling of a slow-moving nightmare that all the things many of us have been saying are going to happen are actually happening. And the suffering, people paying with their lives by government and policy community not heeding these warnings that people like me have been putting out there for quite a while. And then the final consequence is people dying by the hundreds across the United States. And now, as we speak, another hurricane has ripped across Florida. So it's one of sadness, honestly.
Well, yes, and while all this is happening, there was a massive heat wave across the U.S. Southwest, and more people were dying in the heat there, but there wasn't room in the media to cover it. Have you been in touch with any people who are struggling in the Appalachians after the deadly floods caused by Helene?
Yes. One of the groups that I work closely with on climate issues on the East Coast of the U.S. is a group called Appalachian Voices, and their main office is in Boone, North Carolina. Their office was completely flooded. This was also a group that's raising awareness about climate change, warning of the fact that with these fantastic precipitation events that we're now getting, either from hurricane remnants or just from more moisture in the atmosphere, that narrow valleys and narrow and steep valleys of the sort you see in much of Appalachia, there's just nowhere for the water to go. And so the rivers rise higher, the surrounding infrastructure floods faster, and the leaders of Appalachian Voices, this scrappy climate and environmental justice group, you know, had their office devastated.
So ironic and so wrong. I have a friend who lives on higher ground in Asheville, North Carolina. Their river view is displaced by rubble. There is no power, drinking water, or sewage services, and they're not coming back soon because the actual facilities were damaged. Schools and all other services are closed, of course, and the couple had to quickly enroll their two high school kids in a Christian school further north, not their first choice, but that's what was available. So then my friends watched bodies being pulled out of tree tangles and toxic mud. The mud there is toxic from all the products we use getting washed into the waterways there. This is really bad, what happened inland, and so unexpected from a Gulf hurricane, don't you think?
The Appalachian Mountains, you know, we see this kind of flooding in the past. Camille, in 1969, brought fantastic flooding to parts of Appalachia and Virginia, and Agnes in 1972, I think it was, also brought this amazing amount of flooding. But what we're seeing now is it's just happening more frequently. We're seeing heavier rainfall. Everything that we've known in terms of weather and climate patterns in the past are now just amplified, and we should not be surprised that that includes these remnant hurricanes killing communities and human beings.
In 2012, Hurricane Sandy struck Washington and your beloved Chesapeake Bay. Do you think people there are more prepared now when the next one comes?
I wish I could say yes. I mean, shoreline property is still very much desired along the 3,000 miles of tidal shoreline of the Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic coast here. What we are seeing, similar to around the country, is rapidly rising homeowners insurance rates. I think across the country, rates are up as much as 25% on average since 2017. And then, of course, places like Florida, homeowners insurance is 3.5 times more than the national average. We're seeing that in the Chesapeake region, and it should be, you know, a warning sign to a lot of people. But with the increased amount of population and wealth in the East Coast of the United States, apparently the message isn't getting through. But we're seeing just fantastic changes in the Chesapeake Bay. It's a shallow bay. It averages 20 feet, so it's very sensitive to temperature change. We've seen dramatic rise in surface temperatures of the waters of the Chesapeake Bay. And if, you know, the right hurricane comes from the right angle, you know, with like a tight hurricane eye, kind of like Hurricane Wilma. If we were to get a Hurricane Wilma with those kind of high speeds right up the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, you could see just fantastic destruction as far away as Washington, D.C., and, of course, Baltimore.
Well, you know, after the big hurricanes, the media only covers the human deaths and the destroyed homes and buildings. Humans don't even think about all the natural spaces that might be destroyed or ecosystem damage. Do these big storms damage the natural systems like in Chesapeake Bay?
They do. They leave, Hurricane Isabel in 2003 just completely severed a barrier island, an important barrier island off the coast of Maryland. Where before it was one island, afterwards it was two. We get tremendous damage to underwater grasses and to forests. And this is certainly happening in Florida as we speak. You know, when forests are subjected to such high winds and there's tree mortality and then there's saltwater intrusion, I mean, it can take generations for forests to become healthy again. And so, yes, there's always a long-lasting recovery time when it comes to the larger environment and the ecosystems. And unfortunately, as we all know, these disruptions are now coming in faster and faster cycles.
We'll be right back with Mike Tidwell. Then UK scientist James Dyke exposes the climate myth everyone loves.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
But I don't necessarily have to go to the disaster zones because I can see climate-driven changes right in my own garden. We've got certain birds and bugs that are gone. The fruit trees are no longer reliable. You're working on a new book about a really local climate vision. Do you want to give us a sneak peek?
In March, I will have a new book. It's called The Lost Trees of Willow Avenue, a story of climate and hope on one American street. I live right on the border of Washington, D.C. in Maryland. It's an old trolley suburb, 100-year-old home. And we have seen a fantastic loss of our biggest trees in the last 5 years alone. It's just really accelerated. We've lost red and white oaks especially. It's not me saying it's climate change that's killing the trees. It's the city arborists and the regional environmental policymakers are counting more and more deceased trees. So the book is about how, you know, we no longer have to travel to the Great Barrier Reef or to the Arctic poles to see climate change. It's now happening, as you mentioned, in your own garden. And what I do in this book, for 1 year in 2023, I keep a record for 12 months of what I've seen are plausible impacts of climate change. And that is, Lyme disease is so rampant in my neighborhood. I myself suffer from persistent Lyme disease picked up from a tick in my backyard. The winters don't kill off our ticks the way they used to. The trees are receding and flooding. My church, which is a block from my house, we can't keep water out of our preschool basement. So it's a story about how climate change has reached a point where you could take a dart and throw it at a spinning lacquered globe, and wherever that dart lands now, you can write a whole book about that one little micro dot. And the reason I know that is because I've done it on my one block. And it's meant to be, you know, it's here, let's recognize the changes that are happening out our front door, and let's push even harder for clean energy solutions.
I'm looking forward to reading that. I think that's up my alley. Okay, now your previous book, your 2012 book, The Coming Death of America's Coastal Cities, was part of the title, and part of that is the insurance crisis you just mentioned. It turns out a lot of Florida properties were just not insured, and I don't know where that goes next. Maybe a federal bailout, or maybe a lot of homeless people. And it costs a lot more to rebuild after inflation. But after a series of super disasters, you know, from Houston to Tampa, surely some people will realize it is time to retreat from the rising sea. Is that time coming for America, or can we just put it off forever?
No, we can't put it off. I do believe. I was just in Louisiana last year for the first time in a number of years, and I was stunned by how it didn't matter what your economic status was. If you had a small house in the wetland grasses or a fine home in the French Quarter of New Orleans, everybody was being hammered by rising homeowners insurance, and people were negotiating with their insurance companies. Well, if I cut half the benefits, then my insurance rates will only increase 40%. And so people are getting less of their value covered in the insurance, and they're paying exceptionally more for it. And that's just utterly unsustainable, again, for everyone, not just for the poor and middle class, but also for wealthier homeowners. I feel like insurance is that one thing that we can't deny beyond a certain level. I don't know how you have an economy without insured assets. I do believe it's going to reach a point where it's not a matter of fancy homes and only the wealthiest can have homes along waterways. It's when entire communities in places like California and Louisiana and Florida just can't afford to insure their homes, and inevitably with climate change, those homes are going to be damaged or destroyed, as we've seen in Western North Carolina. We'll see. I think Western North Carolina, where 99% of the homes did not have flood insurance, what does a flood this widespread do for migration and a community's ability to rebuild? those abilities are finite. And I do think that insurance is going to be that one issue that we can't keep putting off. And again, hopefully will engender greater interest in trying to figure out what's causing these disasters and what can we do to be more resilient, but hopefully reduce the greenhouse gas emissions as quickly as we can so that they don't become even more fierce.
Do you think the hurricanes will eventually push more people into climate activism?
I don't know. I think they're going to push more people into continental interior areas. I think that's inevitable. We saw that with Katrina. There was permanent migration away from South Louisiana. I keep hoping, Alex, that there will be a wake-up call. We've all seen, you know, we thought Katrina was going to be a wake-up call. We thought the heat wave deaths in Europe in 2003 would be a wake-up call. And it just still feels like we're not awake. You know, you had a guest on, the Greek economist who wrote the excellent book, Beyond the Petri Dish, which I just read, where he called it the Great Silence. You know, we're living in an era of the Great Silence on climate change to our detriment. I don't know. He does argue there that we seem to struggle to hold climate change in our minds long enough to do something about it, but our bodies will certainly move us to action if and when we become food insecure. I hope that's not what it takes, but I have been surprised, honestly, in 22 years as a climate activist, I've been surprised at how we do make movement every time there's a disaster. We do have more awareness of climate and more political will, but not at the level that one would expect rational communities to have.
Well, that's a harsh note to leave it on. Let me ask you this final question. What is the Chesapeake Climate Action Network up to these days? Actually, when I check out your blog, I see more solutions.
Yes, there are a ton of solutions. We are fighting for clean energy throughout the region of Maryland, Virginia, D.C. We occupy and surround the nation's capital. I will tell you from my seventh floor office right on the border with D.C., it's very interesting to see how we pass a new solar law in Maryland, and then on the rooftops of the buildings around us, we then start to see more solar on rooftops. We pass a law mandating that new buildings in the District of Columbia be all electric, and then within a year or two, we start to see new apartment buildings with heat pumps on the roofs. So we can actually look out across this region from our high-rise office building and see the results of our policies all around us in physical terms, which is very gratifying. We're winning the battle for clean energy. There's no doubt about that. In my community of Tacoma Park, the first gas station in the world, as far as I know, that converted entirely from gasoline to charging electric cars is right here in my neighborhood. So instead of buying Citgo gas from Texas, you now get electricity from solar farms across the region put right into your car. So we are making progress, no doubt about that. The great activist Bill McKibben said, you know, winning slowly can be the same thing as losing. So we gotta win faster. And obviously this upcoming election in the United States will have a lot to do with that. And I'm optimistic about that election as well.
From Washington, D.C., our guest is Mike Tidwell. Watch for his new book in the spring of 2025. I'll be keeping my eye out. Find Mike and his passion at ChesapeakeClimate.org, or you can use links in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Mike, good to hear from you, and thank you.
Thanks, Alex.
This is Radio EcoShock reporting. I'm Alex Smith.
Radio EcoShock.
After the megastorms, wildfires, floods, and killer heat around the world, this November, all countries will meet in Baku, Azerbaijan, to discuss what to do. They have a myth to sell you. The latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change offers a kind of free pass. If humans push past the 1.5 degree safety line, maybe that is okay. Future technology will bring carbon back down again, cooling the Earth. Do you believe that? The best analysis from European scientists do not. The new paper in the journal Nature is called Overconfidence in Climate Overshoot. We reach Dr. James Dyke, Associate Professor in Earth System Science at the University of Exeter, James is Assistant Director of the Global Systems Institute. He publishes widely in newspapers and online. Dyke's latest book is Firestorm and Flood, The Violence of Climate Change. From the UK, James Dyke, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me.
What is the theory of overshoot in climate?
The idea of overshoot is both remarkably simple and very worrying. It's remarkably simple because it essentially says if we set a target, or let's say a threshold, for any amount of warming, it could be 1.5 degrees Celsius, 1.6, 2 degrees, whatever it is, in principle, we should be able to lower global temperatures back down to that amount. So at the moment, we are about to breach the 1.5 degrees Celsius warming threshold. And the overshoot argument essentially says, don't worry too much, because by deploying carbon dioxide removal, we can suck CO2, carbon dioxide, out of the atmosphere, and just as increasing emissions made temperatures go up, while then decreasing emissions along with carbon dioxide removal will make temperatures go back down. Now, it's worrying because at the moment we have no real capability to do that. Over 99% of all current carbon dioxide removal technologies are essentially forests and trees, or maybe mangroves, what we call nature-based solutions. Our abilities to deploy machines or technologies to augment that is extremely limited. And when you look at the past track record of these technologies, how we've tried in the past to capture and store carbon dioxide at any significant scale, then I would say you have no confidence these technologies are actually going to scale up at the rate at which we need them now.
And we're dealing with living systems. I mean, anyone who watches nature knows once things change, they may never go back. Here in Canada, when Atlantic cod were fished almost to extinction, they did not return after fishing was stopped. Other life forms took over that ocean bottom habitat. So you multiply this a million times for bacteria and plants and animals. How could anyone believe humans can just wind back a clock of living systems to what they were?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Some people have made the case that our increasing reliance on carbon dioxide removal in this context of overshoot is a little like implying that we've got some kind of time machine that we can wind back the clock on essentially decades of delay to actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But it's not a reversible system. Right? I mean, the recent research, and this, I think there's now quite abundant research, and there's always been a lot of reasons to think that what goes up isn't simply going to come back down. A lot of my research and interest around these things called tipping points in the climate system, and when it's either the potential collapse of ocean currents or the disintegration of ice sheets or the dieback of the Amazon forest, once those dynamics start, they are going to be extremely hard, if not effectively impossible, to reverse. And so the greatest risk with exceeding 1.5, or even where we are with current amounts of warming, is that we could transgress these kinds of thresholds. So even if we do somehow manage to get temperatures back down, in some respects, it will be too late, because further amplifying effects and interactions in the climate system means that we are on a course to a much more different, potentially more turbulent and dangerous climate.
And why would the Overshoot Overconfidence group focus on what they call regional climate change reversibility? I'm not sure what that means.
One way to think about our concerns about the climate is not that we're particularly worried about the global average temperature. I can appreciate that sometimes people might think it's very odd for climate scientists to obsess over whether we are at 1.2 or 1.3 degrees Celsius. But those global changes are masking very, very large regional differences. And the reason we care about climate change is because it's going to affect the weather. It's going to affect what happens in your neighborhood or in your country, in your region. And so if you're a farmer, you are highly attuned to these kind of changes in climate because you know when the rains are later than they were previously. You know when the rains become more intense, such that you can't plant certain crops and you can't harvest them when you would. And from a human healthcare perspective, we are worried about not average changes in temperature, but periods of intense heat waves. I mean, we have heat waves which have killed tens of thousands of people in Europe, one of the richest places on Earth, because there are adaptive limits. We can only adapt so much and so fast to climate change. So when you're looking at changes in the global climate, we should really be concerned about what's going on within regions, what's happening in terms of places over particular periods of time. And when you do this kind of analysis of basically the modelling of increasing temperatures and then trying to drag it back down through global carbon dioxide removal, you begin to see that in some of these regions, whilst the global temperature may be back down, the region's climate, the region's weather, what's going on there in terms of not just the weather, but also what's living there, those ecosystems, those habitats, those things have fundamentally changed, and they may be changed for good.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change AR6 process, that's the latest one. It's not very concrete about overshoot. They talk about going 0.1 degrees C over the safety limit, or it could be 0.3 C or more. In our May 2022 interview, you were the one who told us every tenth of a degree matters now. Should we be nervous about this fuzzy math and the permission to fail, how it's developed in official channels?
We should be really worried about uncertainties in the climate system. I mean, even if we had perfect understanding of what's going to happen and the timescales of which it's going to unfold, there's already abundant evidence that we are already in an awful lot of danger. I mean, we can just see the extraordinary situation. We've got two hurricanes impacting the same region in the United States, separated by a couple of weeks. And this is not surprising. You know, climate scientists have been talking about these sorts of things for decades. It's one of the reasons why we're concerned about climate change. When it comes to this notion of every degree matters, the simple and kind of brutal reality is that the warmer that we make the world, the more energy that's in the climate system, the more dangerous that climate system becomes, the more loss and damages, the more suffering and the more deaths. And in some respects, that's a progressive kind of response. The more warming, the worse it gets. When it comes to tipping points, but then also these other potential kind of abrupt changes, we could see potentially devastating, in some regions, potentially catastrophic impacts. And that doesn't mean they're bound to occur at 1.5 or 1.6 or any amount of warming. What it means is the warmer that we make the Earth's climate, the more energy that's in the system, we're kind of increasingly loading the dice for these potentially catastrophic events. So there's kind of two things that we need to hold on to. One, we might be lucky, but we also might be unlucky. And any sensible risk assessment means we should always prioritize the potentially catastrophic events and do whatever we can to avoid them. And two, this notion of, yes, progressive warming, it gets progressively worse, progressively warming, progressively worse, but there could be things that come at a complete surprise which could have these potentially catastrophic impacts.
Let's get to the official solution on offer, carbon dioxide removal, or CDR. Can you give us an example of the technology proposed for this?
The CDR is not a new idea, and it certainly even predates the 2015 Paris Agreement. But the Paris Agreement is a good place to start, because when you look at the text, when you look at what countries actually agreed to, nowhere does it mention fossil fuels. It doesn't actually mention coal oil and gas, and it certainly doesn't mention phasing them out. What it talks about is the sources and sinks of carbon dioxide with regards to temperatures by the end of the century. And so the Paris Agreement basically says that the international community will stabilize the source of carbon dioxide, well, that's from the burning of fossil fuels, also importantly land use change in agriculture, along with the sinks. Now the sinks are initially what we call natural carbon sinks. So something like nearly half of all the carbon dioxide that humans produce today ends up in the land sinks, so for example, forests and trees and soils, or the ocean. The ocean absorbs carbon dioxide just through essentially chemical processes, but then there's also an important kind of biological amplification of that as well. So when they were thinking about how on earth are we going to limit warming to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, well, you might naively think that that would mean a rapid phase out of fossil fuels. But that's not what's happened. Really, politicians have proposed that we can essentially carry on with fossil fuels. And today, emissions are actually higher, significantly higher than they were in 2015. And what we'll do is spin up the sinks. Basically, if you imagine the bathtub analogy, with kind of water or carbon dioxide is flowing in, if you want to lower the level of that bath, if you want to lower amounts of concentrations or lower the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. I mean, you just need to increase the flow out. So we could plant more trees. We could do reforestation or afforestation. And certainly we do need more trees. But it's become increasingly realized that that's not going to be enough. You can only plant so many trees. They can only grow so fast. And so there's increasing interest in much higher tech approaches. And of those, probably direct air capture has gotten the most interest at the moment. And you can think of that as these sort of massive air conditioning systems that will suck out carbon dioxide directly from the air, concentrate it, then pipe it and store it and ship it, and then pump it deep underground in probably depleted oil and gas wells. And then through that process, what humanity is essentially doing is increasing the flow of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and putting it in the ground where it came from in the first place, because the carbon was emitted from fossil fuels that have been in the rocks for many tens or if not hundreds of millions of years.
According to the Global CCS Institute, there are 41 CDR projects in operation and 351 in development worldwide. James, how close do you think we are to capturing the amount of carbon dioxide we need to remove from the atmosphere, say to get back one of those 0.1 degrees of overshoot?
This is the, I would call it, you know, the $6 million question, but it's not really. It's the multi-billion dollar question, because there is a tremendous flow of finance into approaches to remove carbon dioxide removal. We're currently working on a report at the moment, and we've discovered over 1,300 different companies that are proposing in some way, shape or form to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So that could be through direct air capture. But there is, I mean, if you can imagine a way to remove carbon dioxide, there is some company that is proposing it. And there is an increasing amount of finance. I mean, the leading direct air capture company, Climeworks, has now received private funding of over $1 billion. And that is in response to its abilities, its current abilities, to remove a very, very modest amount of carbon dioxide and then also to permanently sequester it. Now, when it comes to our abilities to, let's say, overshoot and come back down to 1.5 degrees Celsius, I feel, I have to say, that I have no confidence whatsoever that these current generations of carbon dioxide removal technologies are going to get us back to 1.5. And the reason I feel so confident about that is because the sheer amount of additional carbon we're going to put into the atmosphere through existing oil and gas and also coal, but then also the developments of new oil and gas, so the continued financing of new oil and gas, the continued build of new oil rigs and infrastructure, we're going to put so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that it's going to dwarf anything like our abilities to remove it. And so if you go into that kind of time machine analogy again, if you think you can wind the clock back and somehow offset these many, many years of delay when it comes to actual reductions in emissions, our current abilities basically translate into perhaps a few seconds, maybe a few minutes, right? And really, we need to wind the clock back decades. And I just don't see any credible technology being able to do that in the time that we've got. It could be that at some point in the future, new tech emerges that will have some meaningful impact on concentrations. But by then, we'll be well past 1.5. So I just think the message has got to be warming very soon, long-term warming, will very soon pass 1.5 degrees Celsius. And there is no credible route back to safety.
The new paper in Nature raises several weighty problems that might delay actualization of mass-scale carbon dioxide removal. They include things like political resistance or failed business models. But then they say there could also be public opposition, and it's hard for me to picture that. Can you see public opposition to carbon capture and storage?
Many people think that scary technologies like solar radiation management, the spraying of sulfuric compounds into the atmosphere, they're scary, right? You can imagine there's going to be a lot of public resistance to these kind of technologies being deployed. But you would be mistaken to think there are no risks associated with carbon dioxide removal, because carbon dioxide, concentrated carbon dioxide, is potentially lethal. It's an asphyxiant. You will suffocate if you are next to a pipeline which is transporting concentrated CO2 and it leaks. And as you probably know, the oil and gas industry has got a pretty checkered history when it comes to ensuring that its products don't leak out. So you've got the movement of millions, potentially billions, if they can get it to work, billions of tons of concentrated CO2 being piped around, being stored. And whilst it's not flammable, whilst it won't explode, it is silent, it is invisible, and if there were any kind of significant leaks in that infrastructure, you could see serious risks to public health. The other concerns that we've got with carbon dioxide removal could be some attempts to purposefully alter the chemistry in the ocean. There are also broader concerns with regards to its energy consumption. There was a plant in the United States that just recently was wanting to deploy a large-scale direct air capture plant, but we are told it was unable to do that because it could not secure sufficient supplies of green electricity. And of course, there's no point running a direct air capture plant if it's going to be powered by electricity being generated by a coal-fired power station, right? So the current generation and possibly future generations of direct air capture are going to consume an awful lot of electricity. I mean, there are some estimates if it was going to have a meaningful impact on concentrations by the middle of this century, it could be eating up maybe a quarter of total global electricity supply. So these kind of things are not credible, but they might also mean they could crowd out other decarbonisation activities, right? So having a very energy-hungry process, whilst it might be well-intentioned, could actually prove to be counterproductive when you're desperately trying to decarbonize the rest of your society.
We have been speaking with Dr. James Dyke, Assistant Director of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter in the UK. You can find links to follow up on all this in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this week. Take time to notice joy when it comes. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening and caring about this world. Got my pension in the banks that cook. Every living thing, everywhere you look. Beam me up, Scotty, it's too hot down here. Daddy sold the planet and the atmosphere to the... Cook.